Beloved Gladys and Potties, to our final story this week. It comes from Sam Mashinsky, who has been a major player in the Victorian Jewish community as long as I can remember. But he was born and grew up in Shanghai as a Russian Jew, and he's written a memoir of his first 17 years in China. Sam was born in 1934 as the clouds of Holocaust were gathering. It wasn't simply the anti-Semitism in Germany and indeed in the Soviet. This was at a time when the black shirts were marching through the streets of London. And so the period covers the migration of Jews from Europe to Shanghai just prior to the Second World War and the war itself and its aftermath and the communist takeover of China. Sam tells all of it in Goodbye Shanghai, a memoir. And I understand, Sam, that you wrote it for your grandchildren.
Yes, I did. I felt that the time had come to share my story in that detail with our eight grandchildren, all of whom live in Melbourne and with whom we communicate regularly.
Now, the story, the family story for our purposes, begins in the late 1880s in what is now the Ukraine.
Yes.
And in Odessa.
In Kiev and Odessa. My grandfather comes from a little town near Kiev, and my grandmother comes from Odessa. And they met, and for a reason that I don't know the full details, they decided to make the long trek, 9 time zones away, to settle in Vladivostok, in the early 1900s.
And we're talking of a time when the Russian Orthodox Church was rabidly anti-Semitic and the pogroms were up and running.
Yes, yes, and the pogroms forced a mass flight of Russian Jews and Polish Jews to the United States. There was a very famous pogrom called the Kishinev pogrom. And my grandparents, when my father had just been born, decided to make the very long trek to Vladivostok. And probably,
what was the appeal of Vladivostok?
Well, the best that I can recall was that the letters from the immigrants coming to the United States showed how life was very difficult in those early days. And the Tsarist regime were anxious to populate their Siberian territories. And Vladivostok was an important city because it was a port which didn't freeze up in winter. And unless they populated with Russians, a lot of Asians would somehow settle there and they would lose their control. So they made it easy for people to settle, including the downtrodden Jews of European Russia, and anybody who was an artisan got some help to go there. And so they thought that they would start a new life in the language that they knew, and it proved to be, until the revolution, a very wise decision.
It seems that cardboard is in your genetic code, Sam, because you were working for Visi as the in finance in the 80s, and of course your grandfather had this gift for coating thin films of paraffin on cardboard.
Yes, yes. Well, he there established a business, and while I made a trip with my wife to Vladivostok to pursue the research on the book, and we found the house where they lived in, and the next door the house where the factory was, And he managed to get this process going, or thinning this, putting a thin film of paraffin onto the cardboard. There the staple dye, it was what they call smetana in Farog, which is sour cream and the wet form of cottage cheese. And when he had to flee to Shanghai, he amended it to what we call the Dixie cups, and he made a great business out of that. He was a very resourceful man.
Yeah. Why Shanghai?
Well, they left for Shanghai in the late 1920s. Although the revolution was started in 1917 in European Russia, there was a lot of local fighting. And Shanghai, by the late 1920s, emerged as one of the premier industrial and trading ports on the world, and access was virtually open to just about anybody in Shanghai, as it had this, it became a sort of international city, and you just arrived and fended for yourself because of the international settlements that were there.
Of course, there'd been a previous wave of Jewish immigration to Shanghai, had there not?
Yes, there had been, and these waves of immigration came from a variety of reasons of persecution. The Tsarist regime took Jewish children for 25 years into the army, and when the Tsarist regime would lose a war, they would take it out on those young men, and many of them fled, particularly after the loss of the 1905 war against Japan. And then after their various defeats in the First World War, so there were a number of people who deserted the Tsarist army and made their way to Shanghai because of the ease of transport and the ease of somehow settling there.
And the fact that it was, as you say, an open city. And
it was an open city.
You didn't
yes.
need an awful lot of paperwork.
You didn't need any paperwork. You just arrived there, and it was the epitome of a laissez-faire environment.
But, of course, Jewish connections with China go back 1400 years, don't
yes,
they?
Yes, yes.
To the Silk Routes.
There are reports of Jews who have walked the Silk Routes and traded along it. And there is vestiges of an old Jewish community in a place called Kaifeng, where they had found a synagogue with inscriptions. And the Jews melded into the Chinese environment because they were away from the mainstream of Jewish life, and the Chinese were actually not anti-Semitic in the European sense, and they were gradually became assimilated into the Chinese community.
I suddenly have images of documentary footage taken of a Jewish community that still lives in somewhere in the middle of China.
Well, there are a number there, and there are moves being made to integrate them back into Judaism. There is a conversion process that needs to be undertaken because they have adopted the Chinese form of patrilineal descent, whereas the Jewish religion is defined by the matrilineal descent. But there are moves in Israel to get this community revived, and it'll be very interesting how it pans out, really. They look like Chinese, like Han Chinese, in the normal way. But they are Jews who
That's what I found so fascinating.
Yeah. Yes,
I'm
is.
Looking at Chinese faces,
exactly.
But they're practicing Jews.
They're practicing Jews, yeah. Yes. Yeah, they don't eat pork, and they keep a different form of day of rest. Yes,
yeah,
fascinating.
Now, let's look at the administrative structure of Shanghai, because it was quite weird. Can you explain it in simple terms?
Yes. Well, it all started with, of course, the Opium War, which was a war fought for the right to sell opium into China, and as a result of the Chinese losing the opium wars against the British, they establish settlements there where a peculiar term, extrality, applied. And extrality is a short term for extraterritoriality. And that is the fact that foreign residents in those settlements were not subject to Chinese law for any misdemeanors. They were responsible to the laws of their own country. So what you had is enclaves of English and American and German and then French concessions or settlements. And these people did not answer to any Chinese law. They answered to a European law.
Did it work? Did it function efficiently, sir?
Well, it functioned sufficiently well in that to prop up the system, the European powers kept troops there and they imposed a modicum of safety. Now, China in that time was going through enormous upheaval of a civil type, and mainly by students against the authorities for the humiliation of losing the wars against the European powers. And to run away from all of that turmoil, there was a huge influx of Chinese into those safe areas. And that, of course, was the basis of building up not only a trading port, but an industrial complex. And for the period probably from the beginning of the 1900s until the Japanese invaded it, it worked fairly well, depending upon who you were.
I understand it worked quite well for the Chinese living in Shanghai, too, that they were beneficiaries of extrality in some ways.
Well, they were to a certain extent mainly beneficiaries of the safety and from the predatory behavior of Chinese authorities, who could be very capricious. And somehow in the modicum of British and French type of civil justice, so long as they worked and they did their job, so they were left alone, and this attracted a lot of Chinese into Shanghai. The European population was by far the minority, but it basically worked in because it expanded, and Shanghai became quite a metropolis, a byword for luxury and opulence and innovativeness.
And there's still, of course, traces of that, even whilst the cranes are flying up and down the river. To see Shanghai is to see vestiges of this 19th century vitality.
Yes, well, this vitality, of course, derives largely from the geography of Shanghai, which one of the early British traders recognized that it was in a tributary at the mouth of the mighty Yangtze River. That's one of the largest rivers in the world. And on the banks of the Yangtze River live at that time several hundred million Chinese people. So it was an obvious source of trade of foreign goods going up the river and Chinese produce going down the river. And Shanghai was the natural place for a lot of this trade to take place. And now that China has been again opened up by the communist powers, its traditional geographical advantages have reasserted themselves.
Sam, was your life in Shanghai, your early life, affected by the Great Global Depression?
Personally, no, because our family seemed to do all right during the Depression. But the Global Depression did not seem to affect Shanghai as much as other places. It was a trading port. The people were very resourceful. They always were able to find somewhere to export what they manufactured. And it probably was one of the early centers for cheap products to be exported to the rest of the world. But whilst I suppose the Great Depression would have had an effect, but it didn't seem to have.
What about the approaching war? Did that impinge on your life?
Well, the approaching war impinged on my life very much in terms of my schooling, because whilst on an everyday safety basis, I was quite safe and not in any want for food or anything, the various schools I had to go through affected the war. Like my first school was a French school, and when the Vichy took over in France and took over the French possessions and in the rest of the world, the Shanghai administration, the Shanghai French administration, became responsible for Vichy, so I had to leave school because I was Jewish. Then they enrolled me into an English school, and I stayed there until Pearl Harbor broke out on the 7th of December. So I had to leave that. So I went to a Jewish school. And at the end of the war, many of the teachers left overseas. So I went to an American school. And even in the American school in 47, the Cold War caught up and people with Russian names were asked to leave. So as a Jew, I ended up in...
Sam,
in
you've always been a troublemaker.
I was a troublemaker, and I ended up in a Roman Catholic school, and I got my best education there. The Maras brothers were excellent educators.
Yes. Extraordinary story. Of course, you also had some upheaval in your domestic life because your parents divorced when you were just two.
Yes, my parents divorced, and... whilst in many
after all they'd been through together, I find that surprising.
Yes, they did divorce. I don't know why they divorced. There was something happened. It was never discussed with me, as things were never discussed to the extent that I think people are comfortable to discuss now. And I was the beneficiary of grandparents, my father and then my stepmother, to shield me from any ill effects from which this divorce could have affected me. So I was bathed in a lot of love and attention, and in many respects this closeness with my grandparents as a result of that is a catalyst for me to develop this special grandparent relationship with my wife with our grandchildren.
You and I were both raised by grandparents. It's a very interesting experience. Yes. To some extent, you were a boy in a bubble, but clearly protected, cocooned, as you say.
In a cocoon,
but do you remember the atmosphere, the sights, the smells of Shanghai?
Yes, I do. It's for some reason or other, I do remember it very well from a very, very early age. The Amma, my Chinese nanny that used to take me around, I remember seeing the Chinese funerals where they used to burn replicas of houses and cars and the sort of things that they believed that would accompany the deceased into the afterlife, and the scribes in the streets writing letters from the Chinese illiterates to their parents or the folk back in the villages, to even the Chinese women with their bound feet hobbling around.
That's right, they were still binding feet then, weren't
still,
they?
Yeah. It was towards the end of the era, and of course the poverty. The poverty is something that I will always carry with me, the beggars and the children in winter virtually dying of hunger and cold overnight. And we would walk through all of this on our way to schools, from our warm homes to our warm classrooms. And that I will always carry with me. Yeah.
This is Alan Nell on ABC Radio National, and my guest is Sam Mashinsky. We're talking about his childhood as a Russian Jew in Shanghai, and we're covering the period of the 30s and the 40s. Were you made aware by your parents, your grandparents, what was happening in Europe, what was happening back in the Soviet? Did you know about the Germans invading Poland, for example?
Well, when they invaded Poland, I was only five. That particular incident I don't recall. But as I was getting older than that, I started to be aware of what was going on, because my father was very, very interested in the world and politics, which affected us all. And he had one of those probably now priceless Art Deco radios, which he used to bang to coax some response from it. And we used to, listening to the news at regular times was a ritual in our family. We'd all settle down and then the news would come on. So I was very early brought into this whole news gathering and news listening culture and atmosphere at home, which I still practice to this day. And then, of course, as the war wore on, there were these huge maps where, because of the news, they used to plot the progress of the various armies around the world, really. So that was part of our life.
What happened when the Japanese entered the war and took over the city?
Well, that happened overnight, December the 7th or 8th, depending upon which side of the international dateline you're on. And they just took over the what was called the international settlements, which was mainly dominated by the English and Americans, and moved into the French section. And they in prison eventually the nationals of countries that were at war with Japan. But we were stateless because my grandparents had left the Soviet Union, and there as it was then, and did not take up Soviet citizenship, and it was possible to live as stateless people. So we continued in the normal way. And Shanghai, being an international city, also contained a lot of friendly nationals and neutrals like Swiss and other countries. And to my recollection, for us, very little changed, except as the war progressed and the position of the Japanese worsened, then we could see some changes. But this didn't happen to other people. Of course, the Jews who fled Europe were interned by the Japanese in a ghetto. The Sephardi Jews, the Jews from Iraq and Bombay, who were the leading commercial entrepreneurs there, those who had British passports were interned as British. But for us Russian Jews, life continued quite normally.
How did you get on with the Sephardi Jews?
Well, I got on quite well with them. They were in a league on their own. Their religious rites were slightly different than that of the Russian Jews. And I had a few friends in school, and they would invite me to their homes, which were quite palatial. They were modeled almost on British landed estates. And we got on quite well. And of course, as the war progressed, the two communities coalesced in order to help the refugee Jews, as we call the German and Austrian Jews, who were pouring in, as Shanghai served as a haven for them.
We should point out to the listener that the Sephardi Jews of Shanghai originated in Baghdad, which is the home of one of the oldest Jewish communities in the world.
In the world, yes. And from Baghdad, they went to Bombay, where they settled, as it was known, Mumbai now. And they followed the British expansion in the east, and that's how they ended up in Shanghai.
Now, you talk about their skills as traders, but within the community in Shanghai, there were also any number of quite people of brilliant creative credentials.
Yes, and it was, in fact, a city with theatres and performances, and it was a magnet for all sorts of world-renowned singers, leading singer of that time, operatic singer Shaliapin, would visit Shanghai. I remember a big fuss being made about his visit. And a lot of people who were refugees, of course, came with their creative talents. So Shanghai was not only a commercial outpost for making money, it was actually a very cultural city itself.
Well, of course, the world in the late 30s is slamming the door on Jewish refugees. No one wants to let them in.
Yes.
And yet, what, 15 to 18,000 got into Shanghai?
Yes, well, because you didn't need any papers to get into Shanghai. All you needed was to have the funds to buy a ticket on a ship, and there was a lot of shipping going to Shanghai, and they couldn't really find any haven anywhere else. Shanghai became perhaps not the first choice, but certainly it saved their lives by being able to just arrive Shanghai and get off the ship and virtually meld into the general community, fend for themselves. And many did very well until the Japanese forced them into this ghetto on the other side of the river.
I'm just taking moments from this extraordinary saga of yours. But let's move on to the beginning of the end in Shanghai for the family, because in August of 1948, Mao Zedong starts to gain control.
Yes, yes. Well, that was, of course, as I call it, the beginning of the end. Even though Shanghai had been handed back to the Chinese nationalists during the Tehran Conference of 1943, and that after the war, the extraterritoriality rights were abrogated by the English and French and Americans, The nationalists took over, and for a while things were going all right, but unfortunately under the nationalists there was a lot of mismanagement, which was manifest in an enormous inflation. And Mao Zedong, with his armies, who represented a new spirit, started to take over, and by 1948 they had reached the Yangtze River, and we all could see that this was going to be the end of a very special life for all of us. So people started to leave, and we left, of course, eventually. After they came in, we couldn't leave earlier.
Why Australia?
Well, we were stateless, and whilst being stateless benefited us during the war in that we could not in any way be called an alien because we were not citizens of any alien country. When it came to leaving, of course, we didn't have any papers to go anywhere. We were not the responsibility of any country. And we had a relation, Grisha Shklovsky, living in Australia. He was a distant cousin of my mother's. And we appealed to him to sponsor us. It wasn't that easy to get into Australia. It was certainly easier if somebody in Australia were prepared to guarantee to the government that you would not be a charge on them. And he was prepared to do that, for which we're always, of course, eternally grateful to him. So he sent out the papers to us and guaranteed that when we arrived, we would not be a charge on the government. And that's why we came to Australia and came to Melbourne. And I've not regretted this for a moment.
Well, it's time to say shalom to you, Sam, but thank you very much for coming on the program. Sam Wyszynski, his book
thank
is
you.
Called Goodbye Shanghai, a memoir. It's published by Mind. And that's it for another week. Thanks to the team, Kate McDonald, Chris Short, Sasha Fegan, Paul Goff, exec producer Chris Bullock. Don't forget Classic LNL on Friday night. I promise you, it's a classic classic. And of course, it's repeated at dawn on Sunday morning. I'll see you there.